Chapter 5. The Light Sail Hypothesis. In early September 2018, just about a year after Oumuamua passed overhead, I wrote an essay for Scientific American on what the search for relics of alien civilizations, specifically dead civilizations, might entail. Based on Kepler satellite data, I argued, we knew that about a quarter of all stars hosted habitable Earth-scale planets. Even if only a fraction of all habitable Earths led to technological civilizations like our own during the lifetime of their stars, there might be plenty of relics out there in the Milky Way for us to explore. Some of these habitable worlds, I theorized, might have evidence of previous civilizations, anything from atmospheric or geologic traces to abandoned megastructures. But even more intriguing was the possibility that we would find flying through our solar system technological relics with no detectable functionality. For example, pieces of equipment that had lost power over the millions of years of their travel and become space junk. I went on to note that it was entirely possible we had already found one such technological relic. Noting the discovery of Oumuamua the previous fall, I summarized the anomalous evidence we had accumulated about it and then posed a rhetorical question. Given its deviation from its expected orbit and its other peculiarities, might Oumuamua have been an artificial engine? Like my idea of eavesdropping on alien civilizations, it was just a passing thought. And I might have been content to let it stay that way if I could have gotten the star chips out of my head. About that time, a new postdoctoral fellow, Shmuel Bialy, arrived at Harvard's Institute for Theory and Computation, where I serve as director. I proposed to him that we collaborate on a paper explaining Oumuamua's excess acceleration through radiation from sunlight. Because of my previous work on light sails in conceptualizing the Starshot initiative, I was familiar with the scientific constraints and possibilities that interstellar travel by light sail technology presented. The relevant formulas were all fresh in my mind and ready to be applied to possibly explain the peculiar force exerted by sunlight on Oumuamua. To be clear, my attitude at the time was simply, that might work. The astronomical world had been presented with an exciting discovery, an interstellar object about which we had collected a trove of confounding data. We confronted facts that were hard to match to a hypothesis that accounted for all of them. When I proposed that Bialy and I explain Oumuamua's deviation by way of sunlight, I was following the same scientific tenet I had always followed. A hypothesis that satisfied all the data ought to be considered. Bialy checked the numbers, and his excitement grew. The idea I had proposed looked like a viable possibility. This led to a new question. What would we need to assume about Oumuamua's size and composition to explain its deviation? The key question was how thin Oumuamua had to be in order to possess the extreme area-to-volume ratio that accounted for its excess acceleration. We determined that Oumuamua needed to be less than a millimeter thick for the force of sunlight to be effective. The implication of this was obvious. Nature had shown no ability to produce anything like the size and composition of what our assumptions suggested, so something or someone must have built such a light sail. Oumuamua must have been designed, built, and launched by an extraterrestrial intelligence. It is an exotic hypothesis, without question, but it is no less exotic than other hypotheses that have been proposed to explain the outlier characteristics of Oumuamua. Nature has shown no propensity to produce pure hydrogen comets or fluffy clouds of materials that are both more rarefied than air and structurally cohesive. The extraordinary nature of our conclusion rested almost entirely on the presumption that it wasn't a naturally occurring object. The light sail inference may seem outlandish, but getting to it did not require any wild leaps. Shmuel and I went down a logical path. We followed the evidence, and in the grand tradition of the detective work of science, we hewed closely to a maxim of Sherlock Holmes. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Hence our hypothesis. Oumuamua was artificial. We laid out these ideas in a paper titled, Could Solar Radiation Pressure Explain Oumuamua's Peculiar Acceleration? In it, we confronted a range of other questions about Oumuamua. We described the likely damage it would sustain as it roared across the universe, for instance, from colliding with space dust or from the continuous strain of centrifugal force caused by its rotation. We discussed the impact that such damage might have on the object's mass and speed and found it to be minimal. Laying out equation after equation, we drew conclusions from the available data about the object's thickness and mass, which dictated its surface-to-volume ratio. And then, at the end of the paper, we put forth our hypothesis. If radiation pressure is the accelerating force, we wrote, then Oumuamua represents a new class of thin interstellar material, either produced naturally or is of an artificial origin. Considering an artificial origin, we continued, one possibility is that Oumuamua is a light sail, floating in interstellar space as debris from advanced technological equipment. We submitted the paper to the prestigious scientific journal The Astrophysical Journal Letters, which specializes in timely and high-impact papers, in late October 2018. Our intention was to engage the attention of our fellow scientists who we knew were weighing hypotheses against the evidence. This, too, should be considered. In that spirit, we also posted the manuscript before it had been peer-reviewed on the online preprint site archive.org. Science journalists regularly scour Archive for stories, and in short order, two of them found our study and raced to report our hypothesis. Their pieces went viral, and by November 6, 2018, roughly a year after Oumuamua was discovered, everything blew up. Within hours after the first media reports appeared, I was surrounded by cameras. While most of America was filing off to vote in the hotly contested midterm elections, four television crews crowded into my office on Garden Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I tried to field their questions while simultaneously responding to a steady stream of phone calls and emails from newspaper reporters. I had some experience with the popular press because of earlier papers I had written on an array of subjects, but this level of attention was new to me and a bit overwhelming. It didn't help that I was mentally preparing to depart for Berlin to give a public lecture, long in the works, at the Falling Walls Conference, an appropriately named gathering dedicated to celebrating breakthroughs that broaden society's interest in the latest advances in science and technology. I raced home and grabbed my suitcase, but didn't make it back out to the car before another film crew arrived, having tracked down my home address. As I stood at my front door, the reporter asked, "Do you believe there are alien civilizations out there?" A quarter of all stars host a planet the size and surface temperature of the Earth, I said into the camera. It would be arrogant to think we are alone. By the time I deplaned in Berlin, members of the international media were responding much as the American media had. All of this before our paper was even published. Given the media's attention and the need for us to present more of the factual basis for the hypothesis, the Astrophysical Journal Letters published our paper on November 12th. They accepted it for publication just 3 days after I submitted it, the fastest turnaround time in my entire scientific career. I was grateful for the paper's publication. It meant that an ever-widening circle of scientists was considering our hypothesis to explain the evidence left by Oumuamua. But I was under no illusion that any appreciable part of the scholarly field would approach the theory that Oumuamua had originated in an extraterrestrial civilization as just one exotic hypothesis among many. I presumed a majority would be reluctant to consider the idea, and that some scientists would even be hostile. I was well aware of the prevailing suspicion regarding any argument that kept company with SETI scientists' thinking. The outpouring of popular interest, which only grew with the release of our paper, seemed ironic, too, when I considered the relative tameness of the hypothesis. Just a year earlier, following reports of an anomaly having to do with hydrogen atoms, which had been found to be colder than expected in the early universe, I published a paper with another Harvard postdoc, Julian Munoz, showing that if the dark matter was made of particles that possessed a tiny electric charge, they would cool the cosmic hydrogen and account for the reported anomaly. Even though this hypothesis was published in Nature, and even though it was far more speculative than my and Bialy's hypothesis about Oumuamua being alien technology, it garnered much less attention. To be clear, although I made myself as available as my commitments allowed, I neither sought the limelight nor particularly enjoyed it. In the past, when I had set out to draw attention to my work, as with the Starshot Initiative, I was grateful when even a few members of the press responded. And while I had undergone extensive professional training in various fields throughout my life, no one, especially me, had thought to include media training. In hindsight, maybe someone should have. Astronomy and astrophysics are fields that frequently require substantial commitments of time and money, and harnessing the public's awareness of what is possible and what might be necessary cannot be an afterthought. To say that my raising the possibility that Oumuamua was artificial technology met with disapproval is putting the matter mildly. To be sure, the popular media was delighted, and the broader public was fascinated. But my fellow scientists were, shall we say, more circumspect. In July 2019, the Oumuamua team of the International Space Science Institute, ISSI, published their unambiguous conclusion in Nature Astronomy. "We find no compelling evidence to favor an alien explanation for Oumuamua." The immediately preceding paragraphs declared that the extraterrestrial technology theory that Bialy and I had put forward was provocative, but baseless. Yet the article also ends with a list of unanswered Oumuamua anomalies, what the authors termed open questions. They also acknowledged that only after the advanced telescope at the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile was fully operational might we have sufficient data to determine how common or rare the properties of Oumuamua are. It was never my intent to become what the science journalist Michelle Starr labeled me: Harvard astrophysics enfant terrible. My attitude toward anomalies remains what it has been since my first day of grade school, quizzical and questioning. I pause long enough to wonder what might follow if I pursue one course of action over another. When Starr asked Matthew Knight, an astronomer at the University of Maryland and one of the scientists on the ISSI Oumuamua team, to sum up the team's findings, he declared, "We have never seen anything like Oumuamua in our solar system. It's really a mystery still." And then added, "But our preference is to stick with analogs we know." Fair enough. But what happens when we start from the mystery end of the trench rather than the familiar analogs end? What questions arise, and what new avenues for pursuing answers suggest themselves when we entertain possibilities that are counter to our governing presumptions but align with the data we have? This is not an idle question. The data we have forces us to entertain exceptionally rare explanations for it. Several other mainstream astronomers, not members of the earlier groupthink, analyzed Oumuamua's data carefully and found that only highly exotic explanations could account for the object's anomalous behavior. To explain all the known facts, they were forced to imagine Oumuamua was a fluffy object composed of material 100 times more rarefied than air, or that it was a comet composed of solid hydrogen ice. Scientists had to offer up never-seen-before options to explain Oumuamua's proven peculiarities. Of all the many asteroids and comets that we have cataloged, none have had such peculiarities. If these scientific mainstream explanations for Oumuamua were deemed valid enough for thoughtful consideration, the hypothesis that it was extraterrestrial technology, similarly a never-seen-before possibility, deserves no less. The questions that the light sail hypothesis raises, moreover, are intriguing. If we suppose that Oumuamua is an exceedingly rare comet composed of frozen, pure hydrogen, most of our questions dead-end. The same is true if we imagine it as a fluffy cloud of dust with sufficient internal integrity to hold together but still lightweight enough to be pushed by sunlight. In both instances, we can marvel, but that's about all we can do. Statistical rarities belong on the shelves of a curiosity cabinet. They shouldn't give rise to new branches of scientific inquiry. But if we acknowledge that Oumuamua is plausibly of extraterrestrial technology origin and approach that hypothesis with scientific curiosity, whole new vistas of exploration for evidence and discovery open before us. After the media had gotten over the initial shock that the chair of Harvard's astronomy department and his postdoc were postulating that Oumuamua was a relic of extraterrestrial technology, I was accused of seeing light sails wherever I looked. After all, my involvement in the Starshot initiative had been announced just 2 years earlier, and our stated goal was to send electronic chips to the nearest star by harnessing the power of light sail technology. The interviewer for the German newspaper Der Spiegel put it with admirable bluntness. According to a proverb, whoever has only a hammer will see nothing but nails. I replied that yes, like everyone's, my imagination was guided by what I knew, and yes, like everyone's, my ideas were influenced by what I was working on. But I should have added that the problem with the proverb was that it focused attention on the hammer rather than on the person wielding it. Not only do skilled carpenters most definitely not see nails everywhere, but they are trained to differentiate among those they do observe. Chapter 6. Seashells and Buoys. One of my favorite activities is walking along the beach searching for seashells worth collecting. It is a pastime I indulge in while I'm on vacation, when I get to pick a beloved stretch of sand to stroll and study, and I have the free time to do it. My daughters often join me as we examine what has been swept ashore. Over the years, we have amassed a nice collection of delicately attached bivalves, rounded cowries, and curled triton and murex shells. A few of our shells are pristine, but far more are worn down and partially disintegrated, their tiny pieces now part of the white sand we've walked on. Sometimes, while searching for shells, we find a piece of sea glass, a shard from a discarded bottle that, after years of being tossed and tumbled in the ocean, has been made smooth. Under these conditions, even industrial products can be things of beauty. Occasionally, on our shell hunting expeditions, we find other, less beautiful man-made objects, a plastic bottle, say, or an old grocery bag. But such discoveries are relatively rare, and that rarity is easily explained. We try to vacation near places where we are less likely to encounter trash. If our family wished, we could travel to beaches where encountering trash is a certainty. Sadly, our planet has a growing number of them. For instance, Hawaii's Kamilo Beach. Once beautiful, it is now known as Plastic Beach due to the extent of garbage that accumulates there. Its condition is sad, but not all that surprising, given that the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, by some estimations the largest of the world's five offshore plastic accumulation zones, sits between California and Hawaii. And the existence of five such patches is also not surprising, given that humanity puts about 8 million metric tons of plastic in the oceans each year. The more there is of something, the more likely it is you will encounter it. This truism applies equally to seashells and plastic bottles, and to the two potential explanations for Oumuamua I have described so far. Either it is a naturally occurring seashell, or it is a piece of manufactured material, junk or otherwise. Viewing both possibilities through a lens made of beach glass, we can see why identifying the right one is so important, and what implications it will have for both science and our own civilization. Let's suppose that, rather than a plastic bottle, Oumuamua was a seashell. An exotic seashell, certainly, but still a naturally occurring seashell. This line of reasoning has attracted the vast majority of scientists who have considered Oumuamua's anomalies. It comes undone almost immediately, however, when we ask how many interstellar seashells must there be for our solar system to have randomly come across one. No one is surprised to encounter an intact seashell while walking along the beach. The sea creatures that produce shells are vast in number, and even given the size of the world's oceans, there are more than enough of them to make it commonplace to find shells worth collecting. Indeed, if we wished, we could estimate the likelihood of encountering not just a seashell, but a specific kind of seashell along a given stretch of beach. Knowing a little about the number of quagg clams in the waters around Cape Cod, for example, would allow us to predict how often we could expect to discover one on the beaches around Provincetown. The same would go for a conch shell on a Florida beach. If Oumuamua is a naturally occurring asteroid or comet, we can pose the following question. How many interstellar rocks need to be in the universe for human beings to regularly encounter them in our solar system? If interstellar space has a large population of asteroids and comets, just like the familiar family of those bound to the sun, it wouldn't be surprising for us to see them. After all, as I've noted, the more there is of a thing, the more likely you are to encounter it. If interstellar space has a small population of such rocks, however, it would be more surprising to encounter them in our solar system. Interstellar space is, of course, many magnitudes vaster than the Earth's oceans. This means that for us to regularly encounter them in our solar system, there would have to be a very, very large population of such interstellar objects floating around out there. Such rocks are known to be the building blocks of planetary systems around stars. Actually, very, very doesn't come close to doing this inferred population justice. To account for a population of rocks as large as the discovery of Oumuamua implies is out there requires that each star in the Milky Way eject 10 to the 15th power such objects from the rocky material around it during its lifetime. To get a sense of the size of that number, a quadrillion, grab a piece of paper and write down a 1 followed by 15 zeros. It's not quite the size of the number of habitable planets in the observable universe, 10 to the 21st power, but still, it represents a lot of objects coming from each and every star in our galaxy. Planetary systems around stars are the regions where large solid objects are likely to form. Our own sun has not been nearly so profligate with its planetary building blocks. In 2009, nearly a decade before Oumuamua's discovery, I published a paper with Amaya Moro Martin and Ed Turner in which we used a dynamical history of our solar system to predict a population of random interstellar objects. It is smaller by 2 to 8 orders of magnitude than the amount needed to explain the discovery of Oumuamua. In other words, the number of predicted interstellar objects our projection came up with was at least 100 times lower than that needed for the hypothesis that Oumuamua was a random interstellar rock. This by itself does not rule out Oumuamua being a familiar rock, but it does make its discovery in our solar system surprising on statistical grounds. Put another way, the idea that Oumuamua was a naturally occurring rock implies that the population of random interstellar objects is far greater than what we expect and what our own solar system predicts. So either a great many other stars out there are very different from the one nurturing us, or there is something else going on. In 2018, a small group of scientists revisited the question of the abundance of Oumuamua-like rocks in interstellar space. While studying the ability of pan-stars to detect objects similar to Oumuamua, they reached some general conclusions. Among them was the broadly agreed-upon insight that many aspects of Oumuamua are both intriguing and troubling. But they also found that the number per unit volume of interstellar material necessary to have Oumuamua be a random rock requires mass ejection rates that far exceed expectations. Up to a quadrillion 10 to the 15th power Oumuamua-size objects per star, yielding roughly one object for every interstellar volume whose circumference is carved by the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. In two follow-up papers, my former collaborator Amaya Moro-Martin showed that the natural abundance of Oumuamua-like objects on random orbits falls short of the required value by several orders of magnitude, even if every planetary system ejected all of the expected solid material in it. These conclusions complicate this echo of our 2009 finding in interesting ways. One complication has to do with the origins of interstellar material, which falls into two broad categories: dry rocky material, which has little to no ice, and icy rocky material. Dry rocks are created primarily during planet formation. This happens as a result of dust particles sticking together and growing in size to planetesimals, which eventually combine to make planets. But the first of the earlier studies concluded that the number density needed for the random rock hypothesis to explain a naturally occurring Oumuamua cannot arise from the ejection of inner solar system material during planet formation. Not enough material is ejected during planet formation to get us to the necessary density. To get to the needed density of naturally occurring objects, these scientists had to posit an additional source of interstellar objects like Oumuamua. And for that, they turned to material ejected from stars' Oort clouds, the shells of icy objects at these systems' outermost edges. When a star reaches the end of its lifetime, its gravitational hold on its Oort cloud bodies weakens, and they are released. But even if all dying stars contribute their Oort cloud debris to interstellar space, Amaya Moro-Martin found in her second paper, they do not provide enough material to achieve the needed density. The challenge that the natural origin explanation for Oumuamua confronts is the need for a sufficient amount of interstellar material. The rough analogy of seashells helps. You need a great many seashells in the sea to make discovering an intact one on a beach probable. The same applies to a naturally occurring Oumuamua arriving in our solar system. For it to be a randomly encountered object, we need a lot of such objects in the universe, and to get at that density, we need objects released from both planet formation and Oort clouds. Of course, we have already established that Oumuamua wasn't icy. No outgassing, no ice. So, a naturally occurring Oumuamua is very unlikely to have come from an Oort cloud. In short, if Oumuamua was a natural object, it had to have been generated by planet formation. It also has to belong to an unknown class of objects generated by planet formation whose size, shape, and composition make them deviate from a path shaped solely by our sun's gravity without any visible outgassing. At the time of this writing, we know of no other object that fits the second set of criteria. But we know of at least one that fits the first. Not long after the discovery of Oumuamua, we encountered our second interstellar object. By the time you listen to this audiobook, we may well have found others. This second interstellar object is named 2I/Borisov, after Gennady Borisov, a Russian engineer and amateur astronomer who, on August 30, 2019, using a 65-centimeter telescope of his own construction, identified the object in the skies above Crimea. And it was Borisov who first ascertained that its trajectory was hyperbolic. Just as had been true for Oumuamua, 2I/Borisov was moving too fast to be gravitationally bound to the sun. And so, just like Oumuamua, 2I/Borisov had come from outside our solar system and was on a path that would send it through and beyond our solar system. But otherwise, 2I/Borisov was unremarkable. It was an interstellar comet, without question, and for this reason it was distinctive. Any interstellar object is a rarity, but its distinctiveness ended there. Its coma and outgassing resembled our solar system's comets in all characteristics. 2I/Borisov was icy and decidedly not exotic. The point is that the discovery of 2I/Borisov did not help us move toward a naturalistic explanation for the exotic Oumuamua. If anything, it did the opposite, by underscoring how special Oumuamua truly was. When I met my wife and realized how special she was, I married her. The many people I have encountered since then do not take away from her unique qualities. They only add to my sense of wonder at how rare she is. Oumuamua and 2I/Borisov were both interstellar interlopers in our solar system, but other than that, they were decidedly different from each other, for among 2I/Borisov's list of ordinary features, it was from an unexceptional origin in space-time. Oumuamua wasn't. Indeed, its origin in velocity position space is another of its marked peculiarities, and another piece of evidence supporting an unusual origin. It is also another clue that can help us to unravel the mystery of what Oumuamua was and what it was doing out there in the void of interstellar space. To understand this requires an understanding of velocity position space. This can be a bit tricky to wrap your mind around, but it boils down to appreciating that the position an object holds in space is defined not just by where it is vis-a-vis everything around it, but also by what its velocity is vis-a-vis the velocity of everything around it. Imagine a very busy, very wide, multi-lane interstate filled with thousands of cars. All of them are traveling at slightly different rates. Some are passing cars, others are falling back. Some are well below the speed limit, and others are greatly exceeding it. If you averaged these cars' movements, you would find a few cars that were, relative to all the others, at rest. These cars would not be pulling ahead or falling back relative to the rest of the pack. Amid all that motion, those cars would be comparatively still. The same applies to the stars. All the stars in the vicinity of the sun are moving relative to one another. The average of their motions is called the local standard of rest. Amid the motion of all these stars, an object at the local standard of rest, or LSR, is comparatively still, and it is a comparatively rare occurrence. Oumuamua was occupying the LSR. Or at least, it was before it accelerated. Around the time that it encountered our sun, it went from sitting still, relative to the average motion of the stars in our neighborhood, including our own, to moving away from us. Thanks to the kick it received from the sun's gravity, it was knocked out of LSR, much as if one of those still cars on that multi-lane highway was violently sideswiped. As a consequence, Oumuamua was broken out of LSR and sent on a path along which it would, like a tennis ball hit by a racket, speedily depart our solar system. Oumuamua's being at LSR was peculiar. Consider that only one in every 500 stars is as still within the LSR frame as Oumuamua was before it was sideswiped. Our own sun, for example, is moving at about 45,000 miles per hour relative to this frame, about 10 times faster than Oumuamua was moving before the sun kicked it away from the LSR. What explains an object being at the LSR? What would need to have happened to place an object at such a distinctive velocity in our vicinity? As with all of Oumuamua's peculiarities, our answers depend on the assumptions we make concerning its origins. Let us start with a hypothesis that will be more to the liking of most scientists than my light sail one. If we suppose that Oumuamua was a dry rock, then perhaps the parent star from which it was ejected was one of those one in every 500 stars in the LSR frame. Could this explain the fact that Oumuamua 2 is at LSR? Yes, perhaps, if its departure from its home system was exceedingly gentle. Understanding why requires only common sense. An object violently ejected from a star system at LSR would be kicked into a different frame of reference. Only an object gently ejected from such a home system would retain the frame of its parent. At the grave risk of straining the analogy, let us return to the multi-lane highway. Envision a motorcycle that is among the few vehicles that are at rest in comparison to the cars and trucks traveling around them. Now, envision that motorcycle with a sidecar attached only by a single, well-greased pin. Immediately after that pin is gently removed, the sidecar, like the motorcycle, would remain at comparative rest. And if, and here is where we really strain the analogy, the highway was frictionless, the motorcycle and sidecar would retain their position and velocity in comparison to all the traffic around them. Similarly, if a planet at LSR detaches a piece of itself gently, the detached piece would retain the planet's position at LSR. A gentle departure from a parent star is possible, but statistically unlikely. Pieces of planets do not detach easily, and the sort of event that would detach a piece of a planet is rarely anything that you could describe as gentle. A strike to a planet at LSR that resulted in that planet ejecting an object that remained at LSR would be akin to an extremely careful strike undertaken with the planetary precision of a feather. The probability of it happening is estimated at 0.2%. It's also possible that Oumuamua came from one of the 99.8% of stars that are in significant motion relative to the LSR. But for that to happen, the ejection maneuver would have had to be a haymaker rather than a nudge, and a precise one at that. The kick that would eject an object from a star system not at LSR in a way that resulted in the ejected object being at LSR means a blow exactly equal and opposite to the velocity of the parent star. The blow would need to perfectly cancel out the home system's movement to produce an object at the LSR. Imagine the challenge of a surgeon attempting a delicate operation with a crude instrument like a hammer. Either possibility, feather or hammer, renders exceedingly unlikely this hypothesis about a naturally occurring Oumuamua being ejected from a home system at LSR. That leaves us with a third, only slightly more plausible hypothesis. An object expelled from a home system at LSR could itself remain at LSR if its expulsion occurred on the extreme outskirts of the home system. There, of course, the gravitational hold of the parent star is far weaker. Indeed, Oort cloud-like outer shells are where most interstellar asteroids and comets that manage to break free of their birth systems probably come from. The more tenuous the gravitational hold of the birth star, regardless of whether it is at LSR or not, the easier it is for some of the debris in its outermost shell to be pulled away by another source of gravity. Our own solar system's trillion comet Oort cloud is a case in point. Its icy shell is 100,000 astronomical units, AUs, distant from the Sun. Each AU is the distance from the Earth to the Sun, or roughly 93 million miles. The Sun's gravitational hold on the material making up the Oort cloud is far weaker than its hold on, say, the Earth. Way out there, a mild nudge of less than 2,200 miles per hour, what an encounter with a passing star might provide, for example, could be enough to send an object on its interstellar way. So, if Oumuamua originated from an icy Oort cloud-like shell around a host system in the LSR, that could explain the object's velocity. But this doesn't explain Oumuamua being a dry rock. No matter how you look at it, the dynamical origin of Oumuamua, that it was at LSR before encountering our solar system, is extremely rare. And it's all the rarer given our need for a naturally occurring object dry enough to produce no visible outgassing when it deviates from a trajectory explicable by the gravitational force of the Sun alone. Which brings us to our second hypothesis, that Oumuamua was a manufactured object specifically designed to be at the local standard of rest. Perhaps long, long ago, Oumuamua was not junk, but extraterrestrial technological equipment built for a distinct purpose. Perhaps it was something closer in intent to a buoy. We think of Oumuamua as hurtling toward us, but it can be more instructive to view things from Oumuamua's vantage point. From that object's perspective, it was at rest, and our solar system slammed into it. Or, in a way that works both metaphorically and maybe literally, perhaps Oumuamua was like a buoy resting in the expanse of the universe, and our solar system was like a ship that ran into it at high speed. The hypothesis that intelligent extraterrestrials designed Oumuamua to be at LSR raises the obvious question. Why would they bother? I can imagine any number of reasons. Perhaps they wanted to set up the interstellar equivalent of a stop sign, or maybe it was more like a lighthouse, or more simply, a signpost or navigation marker. A vast network of such buoys could act as a communication grid, or it could be used as a tripwire, an alert system triggered when one of them was knocked out of LSR. In that spirit, perhaps its creators wanted to disguise its and their spatial origins. Putting an object at LSR effectively camouflages who put it there. Why? Because math and a little knowledge of an object's trajectory is sufficient to trace that object's origins back to a launch pad. Doing that is one of the primary purposes of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD. Consider as well that any intelligence with a grasp of math and a good map of the universe could trace back to Earth any of the interstellar ships we've launched from our planet's surface. That all of these analogies are terrestrial isn't just a reflection of the fact that so is this book's author. That human civilization has built buoys, grids of communications satellites, and early warning detection systems tells us that it is probable other civilizations might do the same thing. What is more, these conjectures are plausible for the simple reason that any one of them is an outcome that humanity could engineer, build, and launch if we wished to. Our reasons needn't even be interstellar. Just for example, if India had put such an object into space, the scientists at NASA might wonder why, but they wouldn't wonder how there came to be a small, flat, luminous object marked with the Indian Space Research Organization's distinctive logo at LSR. The hurdle to accepting that this answer applies to Oumuamua is, of course, that it requires us to accept that Oumuamua is of extraterrestrial origin. And the hurdle to that is that we must take seriously the possibility that we are not the only intelligence in the universe. A buoy. A grid of pods for communication. Signposts that an extraterrestrial civilization could navigate by. Launch bases for probes. Other intelligent living organisms' defunct technology or discarded technological trash. These are all plausible explanations for the Oumuamua mystery. Plausible because here on Earth, humanity is already doing these things, albeit on a far more limited scale, and we would certainly consider replicating them if and when we explore out into interstellar space. What renders these hypotheses implausible is the inability to conjure an extraterrestrial intelligence. Foreclose that possibility and you moot all such explanations. Refuse to look through the telescope, and it matters little if it does or doesn't show any compelling evidence. Perhaps it is the shadow of science fiction stories, or just a flaw in some people's ability to broaden the scope of hypotheses they will entertain, but entertaining an explanation that posits an extraterrestrial civilization is much like presenting to the skeptical a telescope they outright refuse to look through. The best antidote to such recalcitrance I have found is to think for yourself. If any of these ideas seem feverish or over the top or detached from reality, just remind yourself of the evidence before you. The data we confront tells us that Oumuamua was a luminous, thin disk at the LSR, and when it encountered the gravitational pull of the sun, it deviated from a trajectory explicable by gravity alone, and it did so without visible outgassing or disintegration. These data points can be summed up as follows. Oumuamua was statistically a wild outlier. Using very conservative probabilities based on its shape, rotation, and luminosity alone, a cometary Oumuamua would be a 1 in a million naturally occurring object. Attempt to explain its composition so that we can explain its deviation beyond solar gravity by outgassing that was invisible to our instruments, and you still have an object that is as rare as 1 in thousands. But that's not all. It's also very odd, remember, that Oumuamua's spin rate didn't change. Maybe just 1 in every 1,000 comets keeps a steady spin despite the significant mass loss implied by Oumuamua's non-gravitational acceleration. If Oumuamua was one of those rare comets, we are now talking about a 1 in a billion object. Then there is its lack of jerks. If there was naturally occurring outgassing and disintegration that was somehow invisible to our instruments, those putative jets propelling Oumuamua would have had to perfectly cancel each other out. If that's another 1 in a 1,000 coincidence, Oumuamua is now 1 in a trillion. And we still have to take into account Oumuamua's origin in velocity position space, the fact that it was at LSR. Recall that an LSR birth star is a 0.2% probability, so now the odds that Oumuamua is just a random comet are approaching 1 in a quadrillion. These numbers strain credulity and beg for an alternative explanation. They were what led me to suggest to Shmuel Bialy that we search for another, more plausible hypothesis. And we could come up with just one that made sense for the non-gravitational acceleration. Oumuamua's weirdly steady push was provided by sunlight. This was fully consistent with an important clue. The excess force acting on Oumuamua that caused it to deviate, observers noted, seemingly declined inversely with the square of its distance from the sun, as one would expect if that force was provided by reflected sunlight. but solar radiation pressure isn't very powerful. If it were indeed responsible, we calculated, then Oumuamua had to be less than a millimeter thick and at least 20 meters wide. The diameter depends on the object's reflectivity, which is unknown. If Oumuamua were a perfect reflector, bouncing back 100% of the sunlight that hit it, in this super-thin scenario, it would be 20 meters across. There is nothing in nature with those dimensions, as far as we can tell, and no known natural process that can produce them. But of course, humanity has built something that fits the bill, and we've even launched it into space. A light sail. We arrived at this hypothesis through logic and evidence, in short, by sticking to the facts. But if we take the hypothesis seriously, it allows us to ponder new, incredible questions about how Oumuamua appeared in our universe and where it came from. It even, as I will explain, gives us the opportunity to ask whether we might someday meet the creators of this mysterious visitor. The light sail hypothesis opens up a world of possibilities, unlike the comet hypothesis, which closes them off. The fact that scientific consensus strongly favors the more conservative and restrictive of these two possibilities says less about the evidence than it does about the practitioners and culture of science itself.